Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start the show today by taking a look at how we might be able to revitalize small towns and rural areas through clean power. And we've got a guest on who I think's got a blueprint for us. Michelle Moore is CEO of Groundswell. It's a nonprofit that builds community power. And we'll be talking with her about her new book. It's called Rural Renaissance, Revitalizing America's Hometown Through Clean Power. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you want to know about using clean power to maybe revitalize your town? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Michelle Moore, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. It's a blessing to be with you this afternoon.
Well, I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book, and I call it a blueprint. I don't know if you would call it that or not.
Absolutely. When I was writing it, my hope was that it would be an inspirational roadmap, you know, share a lot of ideas, share the stories of a lot of people who've gone before us, and give anybody who picks it up something they can do in their hometown.
Yeah. Tell us about your background. And I think it's really interesting because you speak to that a bit in the early part of your book, how you arrived at this point in your professional life.
Well, I'm a small town girl. I grew up in LaGrange, Georgia, which is an predominantly rural Troup County. It's about an hour and a half south of Atlanta, right on the Georgia-Alabama line. And, you know, Larry, when I was a young person, when I was in my early 20s, it was my worst nightmare to end up back in my hometown working for a textile company. But that's exactly what happened. And it put me on a path to really commit myself to serving my community with sustainability and clean power. And it has been really one of the greatest blessings of my professional life to be able to dive in, you know, serve my neighbors, serve the folks I grew up with, and be able to share those stories in Rural Renaissance for how people can take this moment of extraordinary transformation that we're in with our energy systems and, you know, use those investments, use this opportunity to really make our small towns, our hometowns, places where, you know, people can thrive and they don't have to move away. You know, they can raise their families at home if that's what they want to do.
Well, I just like the whole concept about local power, rural power, which brings local jobs, which is the way, you know, as you discuss in the book, is the money stays in the community, which I liked a lot. So jobs, the money stays in the community. Chances that money helps the individuals in the community, but society as a whole, because money that comes in is then able to be used for roads, better schools, all kinds of things.
Absolutely. You know, whatever the community needs. You know, one of the things that I really loved when I was, you know, researching and writing the book, and one of the things I really learned from my mentor and friend Curtis Wynn, who I dedicated the book to, was just the brilliant opportunity that we have with our rural cooperative utilities, our small municipal utilities, our public power utilities around the country, to really make decisions together at the local level so that the way we build out our energy systems, whether it's solar or efficiency or EVs or whatever the case may be, we can connect the value of those systems to our local priorities, because it's different, right? America is this beautifully diverse country, Wisconsin to Georgia to Nevada to Maine. And not everybody has the same needs. Not everybody has the same opportunities. But keeping it local, making decisions local, keeping the value local means that we can do what's right, you know, by us, by our families, and by our neighbors, and by the future.
Yeah. And those rural electric cooperatives, you know, Wisconsin's really, I think, maybe the birthplace of cooperatives in the country. And the rural, you know, my grandparents didn't have electricity on their farm.
Yeah, my grandparents didn't either when they were growing up. And, you know, in Wisconsin, I do have to give a special shout out to Wisconsin. And one of the stories in the book is actually about Vernon Electric Cooperative, which built one of the very first community solar projects in the state and in the nation. So Wisconsin and rural cooperatives are in the lead. But when we think about, you know, our energy systems and just to, you know, kind of draw a parallel here too, because with the Infrastructure Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, we're fixing to make a bigger investment in rural power in America than we've made in 100 years.
Yeah.
Since the 1920s and 30s, when all those rural electric cooperatives were beginning to sprout up, when the federal government created the TVA, and when we first moved forward as a country to say, hey, you know, electricity is a necessity, not a luxury, and it's time to turn the lights on for farms and farmers. And we're at exactly that same moment now. But with clean energy, clean power, clean technologies, electric vehicles, you know, all this stuff we see on the news every day is absolutely relevant, perhaps even more so to small towns.
And those rural electric cooperatives, they're still around.
They are more than
900 of them. Set up in a way that can help us.
Yes. And one of the things that's really beautiful about rural cooperatives and cooperatives in general, I found to really be related to their history, to when they were developed, which was really, in many ways, creating cooperative systems so that we could work together, you know, work together for mutual community benefit. That word cooperative, you know, has a lot of meaning in even how rural cooperatives make decisions. But it really, the cooperatives developed at a time when in America and internationally, people were really reacting against what industrialization had done to quality of life. And, cooperatives came from farmers and from workers in factories saying, hey, we're going to take some more of this economic power and decision-making authority for ourselves. So we're helping each other to make our lives better. So there was this mutuality, you know, rooted in the history of the cooperative movement. And not only did those rural cooperative utilities still exist today, all over the country, they serve more than 50% of America's landmass. They're everywhere. But they are still based on those exact same principles. And one of those principles is little d, democracy. So the people who are served by rural electric cooperatives, if you get an electricity bill from a cooperative utility, you're an owner of that utility too. You elect members to the board, maybe you're on the board, and you help to make the decisions about how power serves your community. And that is beautiful.
Well, all of our lines are filled with people with questions or comments. Let's go to Edwin in Stratford. First for a comment. Hi, Edwin.
Hi. I was wondering, in Wisconsin currently, the laws state that two people can't own a solar system and get the benefits. Like a municipality can't own a solar system and put that power directly to its residents. It all has to go through a power company first and then goes out. So can you change those laws to make it more easier for a small town to put in a solar field and get the benefits from it?
Yeah, and you address that in your book for sure.
I do, and there's some changes in the laws at the federal level that even help to answer that question. And, you know, one of the things that's very different, because there are a lot of states, my home state of Georgia, it's true there, too, that only utilities can sell power. You know, just as you're saying, Edwin, but with rural cooperative utilities and public power utilities, too, which are really units of local government in a different way, you know, those utilities themselves are owned and controlled by the people they serve. So in a rural cooperative context, rural co-ops are nonprofits that are that are literally owned and governed by their members, by the residents they serve with electricity. And in the case of a public power utility, they're units of local government. So ultimately, they're also controlled by the people that you elect. Maybe the city council, maybe an elected utility board. But before the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, it was really, really hard for those nonprofit utilities to own solar power, for instance, to own a solar project. And without getting too far into the technical weeds, the way that the incentives work, you know, the solar tax credit is what it's commonly known as. You had to bring in an outside investor because obviously nonprofits don't pay taxes. So how do you get the tax benefit if you don't pay taxes? But the Inflation Reduction Act changed that for nonprofit organizations. So that solar tax credit now is fully refundable for nonprofit entities. That means if your local nonprofit utility wants to build a solar project to benefit its members, that utility can get the tax credit as a refund and can own and manage that solar project for the benefit of everybody, the communities that community utility serves. It's a game changer. And particularly for rural communities that, you know, may have been particularly hard hit by economic woes, rural communities that maybe themselves are energy transition communities. Maybe a lot of jobs came from coal-fired power plants, for instance. The value of that tax credit is actually higher, 40% of the total value of the project. And like I said, it can get a little technical and a little weedy, but it is a game changer in terms of the ability of municipal utilities and rural utilities to develop, own, and operate solar and energy storage projects for the benefit of their members.
So they're going to be able to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're, at the state level, you know, for third parties, so for you or me or, you know, any entity that's not a utility, there has to be change. The state laws have to change to make that possible. But if you're served by a nonprofit utility, by a rural electric cooperative, by a municipal utility, you can act collectively as a community on your own.
You can do that. Edwin, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Our guest today, Michelle Moore, CEO of Groundswell. It's a nonprofit that builds community power. And her new book that we're talking about, which really gives you a blueprint for this, it's titled Rural Renaissance, Revitalizing America's Hometowns Through Clean Power. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at how small towns and rural areas can be revitalized through clean power with our guest today, Michelle Moore. Her book is Rural Renaissance, Revitalizing America's Hometowns Through Clean Power. Again, you can join in with your own thoughts at 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Vern in Eastern Eau Claire County, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Vern.
It's at WPR.org.
Vern, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. Thanks, Larry, for letting me have my comments. For one, solar power, the only reason they build it is because it's subsidized. And like, say, you get taxed for it, well, somebody's got to pay those taxes. But solar power does not provide continuous power. It's DC power. It's got to be converted. You got to have substations and everything else. And it's never going to be practical. It would take a 330-million-pound battery to store the output from a 1,000-megawatt nuclear power plant.
Well, what do you think?
Well, Vernon, I think you bring up a great, great point about how important energy storage is in the picture. Because when we, and I talk about this a lot in the book as well, and it's particularly important for rural communities. One of the things that I learned, actually, that I was really surprised about is that the power goes out. We have more power outages in America than in any other developed country. And the incidence of those power outages is going up, right? Because the weather's kind of crazy, extreme weather. And those power outages tend to impact rural communities even more. Like if you live at the edge of the grid, so to speak, or you live far away from services. It's just your power is out for longer because it takes folks longer time to come to you and get your power back on. And that's not a criticism of any particular utility or of the heroic linemen who work for utilities all over the country. That's just what our infrastructure looks like today. We've got 19th century infrastructure in a 21st century world. And energy storage is a real game changer, because we can pair batteries, and including batteries that work at the community scale or at the residential scale, with solar power, and you keep the lights on even when the grid goes out. And the value of resilience, right? And resilience, I think, is a value that a lot of people share. You don't have to be from a small town or from the country to value self-reliance and resilience as a quality. That's something else that solar and energy storage together can bring to the table. You know, Groundswell works with a lot of churches and communities in lots of different states, building what we call community resiliency hubs. You know, so you've got solar on the roof of the church that's providing some savings to that church, less money, more mission. and then we've got energy storage that helps that church, serve a part of what its historic function has been, right? Sort of connecting people to what they need in times of crisis. And the size of a battery that would serve a church, a community center like that, it's no bigger than the air conditioning unit you probably got outside the walls of your building today. And so as we think about meeting local needs, community needs, what does the farm need? What does the rural business need? And you kind of bring things down to that human scale, which is one of the things that clean energy technology lets us do, kind of go from industrial scale stuff down to community scale stuff. We get technologies and we get energy generation solutions that really fit.
Yeah. Dennis in Two Rivers, will go to you next. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Larry. I think I heard a while ago about transmitting energy through wires. It is inefficient because for every mile or whatever, this power drops. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, sir. It's an important point, and one that a lot of people don't understand or don't recognize, and particularly in parts of the country where our transmission system is older, it's even less efficient. So there's a lot of that efficiency that can get lost over long power lines. And, bringing energy generation and bringing energy storage closer, to the places that we use energy helps us increase efficiency, too. So efficiency and efficiency of our energy distribution systems, it's such an important point. Thank you so much for raising that in your comment today.
Yeah. And Tom in Marquette, Michigan, I think has something that kind of relates to this as well. So let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Larry. Hi, Michelle. I'm wondering where we are these days with development of hydropower as a storage. In other words, use the excess solar or wind to pump water to a higher elevation and then let that water reverse at nighttime or when the wind isn't blowing to run a turbine and generate hydropower. Instead of using a battery, use water as our storage facility.
Hmm.
Tom, thank you so much for bringing that idea forward. And Larry, I love how much expertise the community of listeners you have today and how they're sharing that with everybody and with us. The point that Tom makes about hydro storage is a great one. And it's a technology that's widely used by many utilities as well, and to be able to store power at large scale. Tennessee Valley Authority, for instance, has been using hydro storage for many, many, many years. And Tom, I am not as familiar with that technology or with the utility scale storage mechanisms to be able to report out to you today how widely used it is. But particularly when we think about energy storage at larger scale, energy storage that's using clean technologies and natural systems to meet that need, it's a wonderful solution to bring forward for us to consider. And I'm going to take learning more about that exact technology as part of my homework from today's call.
Tom, thanks so much. I can recall a faculty member in my academic department that I a member of. A long time ago, wrote a, put together a film on the Wisconsin River because it was the workingest river in the U.S. with the hydroelectric power generation along the river. So, yeah, we're acquainted with it a little bit here. By the way, you can join in, too, and I hope you do. The number to call as we talk about clean power in our rural areas, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Michelle Moore's book is titled Rural Renaissance, Revitalizing America's Hometown Through Clean Power. So, you know, we've got the old system, and you talk about changes that we need to see in the old system, and talk about that. How, you know, you talk about energy cooperatives, and we've sort of gotten at it a little bit here, but go ahead.
Well, we have, from my perspective, and the idea, you know, Larry, as you note that I share in Rural Renaissance, is that we have the entire kit of parts, if you will, that we need to make this happen and to be able to build local clean energy futures. And note, there's an S on the end of futures, right? We mm-hmm. don't all have to do it the same way. You know, we can build a future that works for our local community's needs because we have these wonderful local energy democracies all over the country, because we have a federalist system, you know, for making energy policy. But the thing that has happened in the last several decades that's a real game changer is that clean energy technology means that those systems can be distributed. We no longer have to be powered just by giant power plants and long transmission lines. We can bring those solutions closer to home. And what bringing power generation, and I also want to give a shout out to Made in the USA manufacturing. So let's make those EVs here. Let's make those batteries here. Let's make solar panels and wind turbines here in the USA. So we've got those good jobs and we've got that innovation and technology and knowledge and R&D. But keeping it local means we keep the economic value local, too, because I know from my own experience growing up in a textile town that when you're sort of on the early end of the supply chain, so you're in early stage manufacturing or you're where, you know, resources are being extracted, you get less a piece of the economic value of what those resources produce. So being able to have distribution and use closer to home, too, means you keep more of the economic value of the energy that you're creating, too.
Yeah. Oh, Will in Muscadet has something for us. Hi, Will.
Hi. I was calling because on my father's farm, there is a river that runs through it, or the beginnings of a river. And I saw when I was younger, he showed me a plat book for when it was first built, and there was a cutoff of the river, and it ran a water wheel, and they used it for grinding grain or whatnot into flour. So all of the old structure is still there, and the little cutoff is still there, but the river has since like kind of filled in. Now, I was wondering, do you think there'll be issue with DNR if I were to open up that little tributary and try to use it for hydroelectric power once again?
Well, I think you'd have to call them first.
Yeah, I would definitely check with DNR, but I can tell you that there are a lot of communities, a lot of individuals that are using what is called micro hydro technology too. You know, so there may be some great examples as well that would make a good case for DNR or for others for why opening up the source of that river as a source of energy for your family's farm would be a good idea.
You know, I think it might be worth it for you to give us an example. I mean, you have some wonderful examples in your book of rural areas that, you know, did what you're talking about or are doing what you're talking about.
Yes, sir. The rural communities and small towns across the country are leading. Their stories are just not well known. I think a great example actually comes from Roanoke Electric Cooperative, and it's located in northeastern North Carolina. And like many rural cooperatives, most of the households that cooperative serves would be considered lower moderate income. You know, so it's not an area with great wealth, but it's an area with great innovation that is showing exactly how you can use clean energy, you know, to everybody's benefit, including kitchen table financial kind of benefits. They've got community solar with energy storage. They've got EV charging rates that help people save on their transit and transportation costs, make it cheaper to get to where you need to go. And they've got a really innovative program as well that helps people make their homes more efficient and more comfortable. Now, yeah. Wisconsin is a leader in efficiency, especially as we look at the winter months upcoming, helping people save on their bills and live a little better is a priority that is worth all of us thinking more about.
Yeah, our Focus on Energy program here in Wisconsin is a great program. And come January, it's even going to be better because there's going to be more money available. On the flip side of this, you know, somebody like me, I've got a pretty good job and I pay taxes and I've got ways to deduct expenses from my accounts. But there are other people who certainly aren't in my position. And you talk about how this can benefit them as well, for them to get those new energy saving things, because the energy saving is a big thing.
It is, and particularly when we look at who pays the biggest energy bill. And what we call that is energy burden. So it's what percentage of your total household income do you spend on utility bills to keep the lights on and your house warm or cool? And nationally, this is true at the national level, it's also true in every state, that our lower income neighbors carry the heaviest energy burdens. And it's not just because folks make less money, you know, so the math makes it look, you know, one way or the other. It's because our lower income neighbors typically live in homes that are less efficient, that have older appliances. Because when you're just kind of getting by, you fix things when they break, not because you want something better, right? That was my grandparents' household, yeah. You know, working in the mills and I'm really struggling sometimes when those bills would get especially big in the winter months. But there's some really powerful ways to help people alleviate those energy burdens. Many that utilities across Wisconsin and state level programs in Wisconsin have innovated, you know, and many that rural electric co-ops like Ouachita Electric Cooperative in Arkansas have pioneered, where we're using the utility bill to finance utility savings, and you're paying for those upfront energy efficiency improvements with long-term energy savings. And let me say just one more thing about this, Larry, because, you know, my heart is in rural America, is rural communities, our lower income neighbors in rural communities have the heaviest energy burdens of all. You know, sometimes 20, 30, even 40%. Can you imagine paying 40% of your entire household income to keep the lights on and the house warm? But that's where many of our neighbors are. So there's just a real urgent call to action here, you know, especially, Larry, as you note, there's going to be more rebates and more opportunities available for energy efficiency come January.
Yeah, you call it energy poverty, I think, in your book.
Yes, sir. And when we think about just like your grandparents and my grandparents not having electricity on the farm back in the 20s and 30s, many people today live in energy poverty, because if they use energy for its purposes, like to keep us healthy, to keep us safe, to keep us comfortable, to enable us to do our work at home, it's just backbreaking, you know, for the family budget. And energy is a necessity. That's not how any of us want our neighbors and our communities to be living. And there's good stuff we can do about it, you know, and good stuff that helps people keep more of their household budget for things like health and education and financial stability, but that also helps to support good jobs close to home, because you know what? You can't offshore installing insulation. That's got to be local.
It's got to be local. Well, the rural electric co-ops in Wisconsin, of which there are quite a few, if I'm not mistaken, how do they go about this business, given the, you know, or members of the cooperative? I mean, the cooperative is made up of members. They're all owners.
Absolutely.
I was in the Farmers Union Co-op. I paid my energy bill to the Farmers Union Co-op, and every once in a while I'd get a check from the Farmers Union Co-op for whatever savings that the cooperative had. But so let's say somebody's sitting here, they're a member of a rural electric co-op somewhere. What are they? Well, one thing they could do is get a copy of your book for sure. Would be very helpful. But along with that, what other advice do you have for them?
So I would say, number one, you know, talk to your rural co-op leadership and talk to your rural co-op board. Because as you say, you're a member, you're an owner, and you have a voice in how your rural cooperative serves your community. So get that conversation started. You've got agency and you've got authority in it. Two, understand that no rural cooperative is on its own to do this. I know many rural cooperatives across the country are also challenged with the same kind of resource constraints that their members are, right? Rural cooperatives nationally serve more than 90% of the persistent poverty counties in America. So it can seem really hard, or maybe it can seem even impossible, you know, to scrape together the resources that are necessary to start a program, even a program that is focused on energy efficiency and paid for with savings. But there are so many helpful resources available out there, and cooperatives don't have to use their own money to launch these programs. Not only does the Inflation Reduction Act have almost $10 billion in it, specifically for rural cooperatives to be able to build new clean power plants. But programs from the USDA, like RESP, because y'all, it's not energy if it doesn't have an incomprehensible acronym, but the Rural Energy Savings Program, it gives rural cooperatives and, you know, the partners that they may work with access to 0% loans over 10 to 20 years to help to launch these programs. So cooperatives and other small utilities aren't just selling electrons. You know, we're not just selling power anymore, but so they're providing energy services. And those are all important ways that these clean power programs that are investing in and connected to local community development work with our cooperative business models too.
You know, from time to time, I have an IT person or a tech person on the show to talk about Wi-Fi and the web and all this and that. And invariably, we have callers from rural areas who say, I can't, you know, I'm trying to get this business going and I don't have the the facility within our community to be able to do that through my computer.
Yeah, it's terrible, and it's a terrible injustice too. Broadband is a necessity, you know, for business and education and health and well-being and all kinds of things today. And there are vast, vast areas of rural America that are still on something like AOL dial-up circle 1996. And there are ways to change that. And from my perspective, from a rural renaissance perspective, broadband is also clean energy technology, right? To have all these two-way communications between smart, efficient appliances, for that level of smart grid, if you've heard that term, it means that all of our energy systems have to be connected with broadband. But getting rural broadband in place for every American is something that really takes activating on the policy front too, because from the federal level, where the maps are wrong, you know, the FCC didn't even have right maps for where folks didn't have good access to broadband, down to the state level, you know, where sometimes special interest lobbies have tried to stop electric cooperatives from being able to go into the business of providing broadband to their members. You know, it's definitely something we have to pay attention to, and we have to get activated on. Because to quote a mayor I met a few weeks back from North Carolina, no one wants to locate their business somewhere the internet sucks. And he's right. And for, you know, our rural communities to thrive, we got to have broadband.
And, you know, there was kind of a reversal in terms of people's interest in wanting to live in rural areas. Like you, Ed, I grew up on a farm. You know, we mm-hmm. left, but a lot of people now are kind of wanting to return to that life.
They are. You know, I had, when I started writing Rural Renaissance, I had wondered to myself, you know, is it just me? Am I just getting old and wanting to go home? But no, you know, there was a Gallup poll recently that showed that a greater percentage of Americans across every single age bracket were more interested than they had been in years and years in living in small towns and rural communities. You know, maybe folks want that kind of connection. Maybe folks want that kind of space. But we could be seeing a real return to our hometowns.
So I'll tell you a little story. I grew up on a farm, as I said, and then we moved off the farm, but bought a house or built a house right next to the farm, essentially. And we had two farm families, and I went to school with the kids in those two families. And I hadn't been there for a little while, and I went to visit my sister, and those two farms are now becoming solar farms.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. They're probably 140, 50 acres of each farm, but they're turning into solar farms. And a lot of that you cover in your book, too, which there's so much in your book, we haven't even touched the surface of it. But I thought, well, this is a cool, right across the street or the road from my parents' home is a big solar farm going in.
Well, and it can be such a beautiful way, Larry, to keep the land in the family. Yeah. As I know, particularly for smaller farmers. And, you know, sometimes just because of the, you know, challenging economics of farming, it can be hard, you know, to hold on to that family legacy. But, you know, building a solar project or leasing the land, you know, for a solar project is revenue, you know, revenue that can be even greater sometimes than some of the agricultural crops that can be grown. And it enables you to hang on to that land as a part of your family's legacy. And I know a lot of folks, and I've heard from a lot of folks too, who are concerned, you know, about land use. You know, what happens if we put all of our best farmland into solar farms?
Yeah.
But there are a couple of great things for folks to consider there. If that's a question that you've had on your mind, you know, number one, if we look at it big picture, if we wanted to power every single electrical use in America with solar, we'd only need about 2% of the total acreage of our farmland to do it. But even more than that, there are so many wonderful ways to make solar and agriculture work together in dual land use, to use kind of a geeky term, like agrovoltaics and pollinator PV, where even the way that the solar panels are installed really honor the agricultural roots of the land and enable crops to grow, you know, right alongside the energy production.
Yeah, you have some great examples. A great example, I think it was in Colorado for that. Michelle, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I hope a lot of people get their hands on a copy of your book. And let's go.
Amen. Amen, Larry.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michelle Moore, her book is Rural Renaissance, Revitalizing America's Hometowns Through Clean Power. She's CEO of Groundswell. It's a nonprofit that builds community power. It connects solar and energy efficiency with economics, and with affordability, and with quality of life. All three really good things. You know, there's something else that's really good, too, and that is health. And how we can improve our health. Do we have some health poverty? Michelle was talking about energy poverty. Maybe there's been some health poverty as well. Maybe there are some ways that we can deal with it. And there's a diversity summit that's coming up that's going to honor Indigenous health, past, present, and future. And we're going to talk about that next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.